Hello and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, or even just doesn't know it exists, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the writer and podcaster, Andy Inutko. Andy, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, I love these episodes. This is one of our non-movie episodes, because we do cover a lot of movies, naturally. But this is not a movie episode. And in fact, I believe this is only the second episode we've ever done about an actual person, a real person. So please tell us what you've come on the show to talk about. Give us some context about this person, why they are maligned, and why you believe that that is wrong.
Okay, well, first of all, I have to say that I am part of the problem. It took me a long, long time of listening to popular cultural commentary that Ringo Starr was, oh my God, the luckiest man in the world. I mean, to be kind of a, okay, then you turn on the condescending mode. I'm not saying he's not a capable drummer. Okay, but my goodness, he was certainly a regular kind of plain Jane studio drummer to fall in with the three most brilliant musicians of the 60s, poof, and just right on that rocket ship. What a lucky, lucky guy. And it takes you a while to... it's just that all through my life, I've had that sort of thing, like, I've been reminded of this, that Ringo Starr is just the kind of the funny, offbeat kind of guy. He's the guy who, like, he shakes his head and he's smiling as he's drumming, rocking back and forth. And popular culture keeps putting this idea into play. I remember years and years ago, Saturday Night Live, there was a sketch involving with the four Beatles, set in the 60s with the four Beatles, like 1963, 1964. And I think the thing was there was a fifth Beatle that they were going to kick out. And of course, John and Paul and George are arguing, and occasionally they throw to Ringo, and his only line ever, and he says like eight times, is like, whatever you guys want to do is fine with me. I'm just lucky to be here. And there's another sketch like a couple of years later in which there's like a Beatles auction. Ringo Starr was the musical guest, and there was a Beatles auction to open the show, in which, and now here's John Lennon's toothbrush. Now, we don't know that he used this, but it was in a lot of items that someone bought at auction that included what was probably a piece of stationery paper that from a hotel where the Beatles once stayed at. And of course, it's, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 for the toothbrush that might have been owned by John Lennon. And now that's sold for $50,000. And now our next lot is Ringo Starr. And when Ringo, in like one of his original like 1960s outfits, is wheeled out on a hand cart. Ringo Starr, he is an actual Beatle, joined the group for 1960, performed on all of their major albums, and kind of starts the bidding at, I don't know, $1,000, and there's no bids. And there's like no one's bidding, and then suddenly a hand goes up. Oh, yes, you bid $50. Like, I just want to know, is that like, well, that band outfit, did like Paul ever wear it or touch it? No? Like, okay. So that's what I'm going for. And I think that there's sort of a cultural IQ test that you go through as you continue to develop and grow. If you're a kid, you're kind of ignorant, and that's okay, because that's the definition of being a kid. And of course, you hear about Paul McCartney, and that Paul might be, you start respecting Paul and you start respecting John immediately, because of course, so their names are on every single song. And then your next level of sophistication is when you realize that the brilliance of George Harrison is absolutely the equal of Paul and John, even as a songwriter. He just didn't get as many tracks, and you realize it kind of opens a new door. It's like the part of a house you rarely use, but then you suddenly spend some time in this basement closet that you haven't really used in a year, and you suddenly realize, oh my God, there was original molding here, and this is wonderful. And it takes you a while to realize how great Ringo Starr was. He wasn't just a capable drummer, and the people who are condescending about his talents say, well, he was a good timekeeper, he was perfectly fine, he certainly gave it the sort of the group the energy they originally needed to get them launched into the stratosphere, and wasn't it nice of the rest of them to keep him around even after they could have replaced him with just about anybody. But you start to realize that no, he was legitimately great. He was not just a great drummer for the Beatles, but also a great drummer, period. And it comes down to realizing that it's music is about expressing yourself creatively and not showing off. It's about having a feeling and being able to express that feeling through this instrument. Like in opera, for instance, it takes you 10 to 15 years for an opera performer to just get the basic skills necessary that they don't have to think about what they're doing with their voice. All they're thinking about is, how do I want to express this thought? How do I want to express this feeling? Here is a line that Bizet or Verdi wrote 100 years ago. How do I express this? And you don't even have to think about it because you've got all this technical skill. And Ringo is exactly that way. He's expressing himself through, he has the ability to drum like pretty much any drummer that you consider to be a superstar, but he chooses to express himself through the motifs and the manners that he's using. And when he's, I think you did the same thing that I did for the past week or so since we put this on the schedule. I've been listening to all the Beatles catalog all over again, but this time really just trying to listen to the drums. And I've also been listening to all my other favorite rock music, but again, trying to listen to just the drums because I'm not a music expert. So maybe I'm off my tree a little bit here, but you don't see, you never hear Ringo just going, it's not this repetitive thing that you could do. It's always suiting and following what the music is doing and supporting the music in every way. There's complexity there, even in the simplicity. There is a deliberate choice. He's not drumming simply through a certain passage just because that's all he knows how to do. It's because he's decided that, no, I don't want to, the melodic line is now being carried by that instrument over there, not by the drum. The drum should, if anything, make you think about that guitar line even more. The phrase that came to mind over the past week is that the other three Beatles, in the terms of a really good stew, they were the meat, they were the seasonings, and the vegetables. I think that Ringo Starr was the 24 hours that those ingredients simmer in the pot. You know, you can have two different dishes, same ingredients, same recipe, and you taste the ingredients, but what you can't really identify is, why does this batch taste 10 times better? And it's because of Ringo Starr's idea that it's all about the music. The drums are there in support of the music. I'm not supposed to be a flashy drummer with 800 cymbals around me. I don't really want a drum. I have to have my arm broken to even do one drum solo throughout the entire catalog. And even then, it's not, I'm going to be like Animal flailing on every skin whatsoever.
Right. It's hardly Neil Peart, is it? Yeah.
Exactly. And so I just had tremendous respect. And when you, the last album I listened to was actually Yellow Submarine, which is an album that I really had not listened to in years. I didn't actually own it. I had to listen to it via streaming. And it gave me another insight that there are a couple songs that in the Beatles catalog that they're not really there. You know, I was in the Yellow Submarine soundtrack. I was looking at Only a Northern Song, which, and doing lots of reading over the past few weeks, just because I'm now kind of interested in this. I never really paid attention to it, but it was one of George Harrison's, you know, screw you songs. When he was upset about business dealings with the Beatles, he would occasionally write a screw you song. And this was because all the Beatles music was being published by Northern Songs, which was primarily driven by John and by Paul. And so sort of as a being upset that his publishing is being controlled by Northern Songs. So it's this dismissive blah, blah, blah. So as a result, there isn't a lot of passion from the lead performer or a lot of passion being added by the composer. So that's where Ringo Starr becomes this really dynamic jazz drummer. And again, not flashy, but you listen to the drum track, and now that's where you see that there is nothing predictable in a single measure of this, that he's there to, he realizes that this was kind of a walking pace sort of song with, again, not a whole lot of love behind it, not George saying this is the song that's going to transform the world and bring about universal peace and harmony. It's like, I'm kind of steamed about this contract I had to sign. I'm kind of steamed that this song is probably not going to be in any of the big albums. And so he was left to Ringo to say, I got to make this worth it because this is still a Beatles song. So the last thing that occurred to me is that if you don't understand, if you still are kind of dismissive about Ringo Starr's drumming and you think that, but it's so simple and gosh, anybody can do that. Think about a painting by Mondrian. You know, think about a Jackson Pollock action painting. There was a line that I love. I wish I remember where it came from. About certain kinds of modern art, where modern art, by definition, sits at the precise point of intersection between, hey, I could have done that, and yeah, but you didn't, did you? You know, because anybody can get, here is a piece by Mondrian, which is just right angles, black stripes, and fields of color in between them. Yes, get out any drawing app on your phone, draw a bunch of rectangles and color them in, and you could reproduce that exactly. What you could not do was invent the original. What you could not have done is come up with the idea of how about this new style of art that is really just all color fields. So, yes, you could reproduce Ringo Starr drumming, but could you have invented it? Could you have kept up with everything that the other Beatles were doing? And they were all really trying to drive themselves to become better songwriters. And could you have, when George Harrison again comes up to you, and he's come back from months at the ashram in India, coming up with this music that has these this meter that is completely weird because it's Indian influenced, and now you have to figure out how to go bum ba ba bum ba bum ba bum 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 bum. Can you come up with a drum line that will match this beat? And yes, you can. When Paul McCartney comes to you and he wants to do this sort of old timey When I'm 64, can you create a style of drumming that matches that? When John comes at you and he's still coming down off of something that can only be obtained by veterinarians, can you tie it all together with a drum line that makes it look like it's all cohesive? So I've come up with this thinking that, knowing that he is absolutely the equal of every single member of that group. And this is something that the other Beatles have been saying for decades. And it's just weird that it only took me until about 5 years ago to really fully appreciate that.
Well, I think, and you know, you're hardly alone, so you can't really be blamed for that. I'm glad that you mentioned his ability to evolve and invent, literally invent styles along with the rest of the group, because that is something that really does get, even by people who will defend Ringo, that's something that often gets overlooked. But it's really important, you know, look at, as you say, things like When I'm 64 or Helter Skelter, which, you know, it, many people will tell you is, many music historians will tell you, was basically the first heavy metal song. Now, you know, there's an argument around that, and that's veering more into my sort of field of music knowledge, admittedly. But, you know, everything on that song just sounds unlike anything that had been done before. And you can say that for so much of the Beatles catalog. I mean, I know you and I were both on the album draft episodes of The Incomparable last year. And, you know, I know as a result that you are much more of a Beatles fan than me. I like the Beatles just fine, but I'm not a huge, you know, I'm just not as big a fan as many people. But what I do appreciate is great songwriting and great musicianship in the service of great songwriting, which I think ties back to what you were saying about his technical ability. You know, Ringo was never a sort of virtuoso drummer in the sense that we think of somebody like a Neil Peart or an Alex Van Halen or guys like that who are just all over the drum kit, ridiculous technical ability. No, Ringo was not that. But what he was the absolute best drummer for those songs, because as you say, he supported the songs. He, you know, sort of made the drums part of the group, which at the time, and again, we've got to put all this in context, at the time in the 60s, that's not what drummers were. Drummers were session guys who were just sort of hired to sit at the back and keep a steady beat. You know, and the most respected of them were the ones who could do that without ever going off time or making a mistake. And that's something else that I think people only come to appreciate, well, especially musicians often only come to appreciate later in life. I can't tell you the number of heavy metal drummers, especially, because as I say, that's more my kind of field. I can't tell you the number of heavy metal drummers who have, you know, started their careers going absolutely 10 to the dozen, hitting everything in sight, crazy technical ability. And then as they get older, they get simpler and simpler. And it's not because they're losing ability. It's because what they're gaining is the appreciation of just holding down a really solid beat and appreciating with the value that that brings to the music.
Yeah, that's such a wonderful and simple and basic statement that's true of pretty much every creative expression. If you really want to, if you don't know anything about a writer, a singer, anything, you just look at how much spray paint, how much glitter, how many flashing lights are they trying to put on their performance? How desperate are they to prove that, look, I know how to hit these drums as yes. fast as possible. And I know how to maintain a beat with one hand and be hitting here we hit the ceiling of my knowledge of drums and hit the other thing with the other hand. please don't be blown away by my technical knowledge. It's like when you hear a vocalist, it's why you're not wrong to like whatever you like. You never have to defend that. So I'm not saying that you're wrong to like these singers who
go crazy up and down the scales. Yeah.
It's like you have technical ability. That's great, but it's like you've got 88 keys on the keyboard and you want to make sure you hit every one of them so you can prove that you can hit all of these keys. Whereas you get these other singers that maybe they don't even have the technical instrument that you have, but they know how to use it effectively. Can you sing like Janis Joplin? No, you probably can't. Can you sing with Amy like Amy Winehouse did? No, you probably can't. And that's what that's what sophistication is all about. That's why I keep coming back to you. Just like right now, a part of the times that I've stopped and stammered over the past 20 minutes, I don't have to think about how I'm using my throat, how I'm using my lungs, how I'm using the muscles inside my mouth and my face to say these things. I'm just thinking about what I want to say and how I want to express myself. And if I'm going to, I don't have to prove how loudly I can speak or how fast I can speak. All I want to have to do is focus on what I want to say. And that's when you make something that's truly beautiful and compelling. And that's why Ringo is exactly at the apex of his craft. And that's why you do get mostly people who have had some experience who speak with great reverence about what he did. And then there's trivia too. I was really pleased to read about how he is number one. Things that were blaringly obvious, but I didn't notice until I started really trying to read up on Ringo to prepare for this. I really never noticed that before. But he has every single time, even when he's in the studio, he's got a bass drum. He's got one drum here, another drum here. He's got a cymbal there. He's got like a tom-tom. Like you buy.
It's the most basic kit you could imagine, essentially, in order to play rock music. You can't really have any less drums.
Right. This is like if your kid like asks for a set of drums for Christmas and you go to the mall. This is the kit that you buy. And you see him in the studio. He's a master of how to play them. He's sometimes putting like towels over one of the drums because he wants a muted thing. I didn't notice this before in some of the early videos. He literally has a pack of cigarettes and a lighter like on this drum. And it's not because he wanted to be able to get to his cigarettes really quickly during the breaks. It's because he liked the effect, the slightly muted effect that he had. And the other thing that it never occurred to me, but it made me even more respectful of how inventive and innovative he was. So this is a story he tells a lot during interviews. So he is naturally left-handed.
Yep.
But he's playing a right-handed set of drums, which means, and because he was self-taught, that means that he had to teach himself a new style of drumming without knowing that he was doing this. He was just setting up the drums the way that everyone sets up their drums. The knock-on effect of that is that drums are set up for a specific reason for these right-handed drummers, because there's a drum you always want to hit, so let's make sure that your right hand can get right at that. But when Ringo's playing, he can't get at that drum easily, which meant that he grew up not making the most obvious choice a drummer can make in order to set a beat or to set a fill. He had to invent something because his left hand is in the wrong place to do that. And that's when, again, I can't claim to be a musicologist or anything like that, but it really puts what you're listening to in such a more interesting context, that he is inventing a new form of drumming, and that's why so little of even his normal timekeeping drumming sounds like what I've been hearing on all the other music of the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s that I was listening to.
Yeah. Well, and that's also, I mean, that Ringo was one of the first, he was one of the first rock drummers, period. But he was certainly one of the first rock drummers to do really rapid, repeated hi-hat hits, like, you know, doing like four or even eight hi-hat hits during a bar, whereas previously that was because it makes so much noise. That was not something most drummers did. And I think one of the reasons he was able to do that was because, of course, he was using his non-dominant hand. Whereas, you know, he's using his dominant hand to hit the snare and his non-dominant hand to hit the hi-hats. Whereas a right-handed drummer, it's the other way around. And one of the best examples of how he's playing is different because of him being left-handed is the fills on A Day in the Life, because they're kind of backwards. They're not how a regular right-handed drummer would think to play a fill. And I'm sure he probably wasn't thinking consciously, but because he being left-handed and playing a right-handed kit, it just comes out a bit different and a bit weird. It's a bit like, you know, Jimi Hendrix being the left-hander playing the upside-down guitar. You are naturally going to end up playing unusual, interesting things if that is how you learn an instrument. And I just wanted to talk, you were talking about sort of the idea of something becoming second nature. You know, you do it for so long that you no longer have to think about it. And the comparison I always make with Ringo is to Keith Richards, because everybody knows Keith Richards' style. Everybody knows the Rolling Stones music. Keith Richards is not, he's a fine guitar player, but again, he's not a virtuoso. You know, put him up against some Yngwie Malmsteen or something, you know, and of course he's not going to be able to play that sort of ridiculously technical stuff. And it doesn't matter. You know, people love Keith Richards' guitar playing. He regularly rates as one of the all-time greatest guitar players, and it's precisely because of this, you know, devotion to the song and to the music rather than showing off and his own technical ability, you know. And he doesn't even have that much technical ability in the sense that we think of it in terms of playing a million notes a minute. But what he does have is the technical and the lifelong learned ability to play exactly what he needs to play whenever he needs to play it. And that's what I think, you know, I'm agreeing with you basically. I think that's exactly what Ringo has. But because Ringo's a drummer, and so they're not notes per se, he's not per se playing a melody, it gets overlooked.
Yeah, and particularly because, again, Ringo's whole philosophy, and this is, you'll read this from his own in interview after interview, that it's not about me, it's about the song, it's about the music, it's about the emotion. And so, as a result, it really is difficult to pay attention to how the drums work in a Beatles song until you spend an entire week and say, I'm going to try to not listen to anything but the drums. And it's hard. It's almost impossible to find a passage in which he's not thinking, in which he's just going dip, 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 dip. There's always a dip, 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 then dip, 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 dip.
Right. Once you get past their initial sort of, you know, pop phase, and even that was still interesting stuff. But once you get beyond that and you get to albums like Revolver and onwards, yeah, there's almost, he almost never plays just a straight repetitive four square beat.
Yeah. And nobody inside that recording room was telling Ringo, I want you to play the drum like this. I want you to start off by going da 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 da. Every single signature in there was not the result of a command by the great Paul McCartney or the great John Lennon. As a matter of fact, one of the famous Paul McCartney stories also really makes Ringo look even better, because there is the discord that erupted in the Beatles in the later years, of course, was very, very famous, partly because now you've got three really temperamental songwriters who know exactly how they want their song to come out and not necessarily appreciating, like the Paul talks about how recording Hey Jude, how a rift between him and George kind of widened a little bit, because he, while they're working things out, working the arrangements, Paul would be going, "Hey Jude," and then George, "Don't make it bad," and he says, "George, no, this is quiet. There's no guitar between Hey Jude and Don't Make It Bad," and then you think about how George is going to be, Ringo is going to be exactly the opposite of that. He's going to be the person who realizes that it's okay if there is no drum whatsoever in the first 19 minutes of Let It Be. There's the other famous song about how he didn't realize they're going for a take, so he went to go to the bathroom And when he heard the music, when he heard Paul starting to play, he quietly tiptoed in and got behind the drums and was able to come in on the beat where he had decided where's the correct beat for this. Because just the idea of it's okay to let the piano have this song for the first 20 seconds of this, because that's how the song should go. It's just amazing.
Well, it's okay to let a song breathe. I mean, and that's something that again comes with maturity. You find the same thing with artists, with fiction writers, with any kind of artist or craftsman, I think, is, you know, yeah, the ability to sort of actually, it's okay.
I am a Beatle. People, I have established that I know what I'm doing. I don't have to prove that I belong here.
And just that it's okay not to, as you said, to just stuff everything in there. Yeah, to prove, you know, that you can. Sometimes it's okay to just let things stand by themselves. Paul McCartney, in an interview after the Beatles had split and everything, said, I think it was after anyway, did say, because Ringo, of course, also, ironically, has probably had the most success doing things that aren't music of any of the Beatles. And one of the things that Paul said was that, like, you can't put your finger on it. You know, and he meant this in a, he was being complimentary. He said, there's something about Ringo, whether it's music or his acting or whatever, there is something about him that just, you know, works and people like him and he's relatable and he's just got this charisma and this ability that, and you can't put your finger on it because he's not the most technical drummer in the world. He's not the best actor in the world, but there is something about him that he is self-assured enough, I think, that he knows what he can and can't do. And he is, yeah, always in service to the work, whatever the work happens to be.
Yeah. There's so many reasons why I respect him. One of them being that, you have to really got your head together to be one of the Beatles and not wind up in any way whatsoever in sort of a self-destructive inferiority complex, saying that, no, I've got to become a songwriter too, because now even George is getting at least one track on every side. I have to prove that I can write songs as well. Or here is a real screamer rocker that Paul is doing. I got to make sure that I announce I have just as big a presence on at least one track in this album as everybody else did. And we get back to the famous story about how for the side B of Abbey Road, he hates doing drum solos. He thinks there's no point to them. He thinks that they're self-indulgent, which I finally have to agree with. That I love drum solos. I love that when you listen to Buddy Rich, yes, of course, the entire song is about, we're going to play a little bit of music and then Buddy Rich is going to wail on these drums for about 2.5 minutes. And then there's going to be some more music while he gets hosed down. And then he's going to have another drum solo for another 2 minutes. And it's great. It's wonderful listening to what seems to be an octopus with a drumstick in every single hand surrounded by taut skins. But you realize that this is not really music. What it is drum solos separated, but it's all the drum solos I've heard, they're great, they're wonderful, but the song itself turns into, we're going to stop the song and now Preston is going to have a drum solo for a minute, and then when he's done we're going to resume the song again. Whereas he found a way to do a drum solo that was understated, could be done in that tiny, tiny little drum kit, but nonetheless, it ends with bum 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 bang bum bum bum. Like it feels as though this is the gates to the Colosseum opening. This is the gladiators and on horses simply tramping into the stadium and then setting up the big battle that's going to happen as these three guitarists just trade licks over and over and over again.
It's also one of the shortest drum solos ever, I think.
Yeah, you can see how much, but as much as he hated it, it is pure and inventive.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. I think it was also the first time, the only time perhaps, that his drums were recorded in true stereo rather than being hard panned left and right, because again, putting things in context, a lot of people, younger people frankly, sort of have to realize that the Beatles, you know, came about in an age of mono. Stereo was still a pretty novel new thing. Even with Sgt. Pepper's, it was not that they didn't use it, But it was a crazy new, like, wow, can we do stereo? Are we not mixing this for mono? You know,
it was like 3D televisions. Like, right. Let's do it. But that's not what we're making. Let's just, you know, people are not going to be watching this in 3D, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. And so it wasn't something they ever really focused on. And yeah, the drum solo in at the end of that side is the end of that medley is that I think, as I say, the only time his drums were recorded in true stereo rather than recorded mono and then, as I say, panned hard left and right. So it's kind of fitting, really, that would be the only drum solo he ever did for the Beatles, anyway.
It's also kind of interesting. I bought the 50th anniversary Sgt. Pepper album, and I've read that part of the remix kind of reflects the fact that now the world kind of understands that there were four Beatles, not just two, not just three. And I guess I've read that this new mix, whereas the original mixes didn't necessarily minimize Ringo's drums, it realized that that's not the star of the show, so we don't have to really emphasize it. And this new mix makes it really a lot clearer what Ringo was doing. I would really look forward to seeing. I know that part 20% of the music industry is about trying to figure out a way to get us to buy the Beatles albums all over again.
Yeah, true enough.
But, and so I don't want to give anybody ideas, but yeah, if they said we're going to do the Ringo mix of this album, I would at least listen to it on Apple Music and then maybe buy it. It's one of the great things about this new, you could call it a glut of Beatles studio releases, is that now you get to here is a kind of like a rehearsal track in which Ringo, it's pretty much the entire song that you're familiar with as recorded the way you're familiar with it. But here Ringo truly is, he's just there to keep time for the group. And so what would happen if you really did have a not very talented, not very creative timekeeping drummer? And that's when you realize that, oh, this is like the difference between canned beef stew and beef stew that they've reheated on the stove, and beef stew you've made from scratch and it's been spending an entire day on the stove. Right. It's like, it's the same song. It's not bad. It's still excellent, but boy, do I love Ringo now.
But like Paul McCartney said, there's just, you can't put your finger on it, but there's something just isn't right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The analogy he keeps making, which is pretty brilliant, is that it's like the Beatles were like four corners of a square. If you take away any one of those corners, it all collapses. There is no square. There is no shape to it. And it did take me a long number of years before I fully appreciated that. It took me a long number of years where I would not just join in on knee jerk jokes about Ringo Starr. When it became not quite so offensive to make jokes about how we're running out of Beatles, I said, everybody's praying that please don't let Ringo be the last surviving Beatle, because we want a better, no, that was stupid. That was insulting. That was dumb.
Okay. Let's get to that in a moment. I just wanted to say, you were talking about the remixes. The other thing, of course, is that, and you can really notice this if you say, take a sort of a quick journey through not just the Beatles, but through the history of, like, you know, from the early beginnings of rock and roll through to modern music. Basically, every decade, the drums get louder in just general pop and rock music. And they come more to the fore. And now it is, you know, I mean, we reached a point in the 90s where a song can literally be a machine synthesizing drums as loud as possible with a few minimal instruments in the background, you know. And I'm not knocking that. I like plenty of that music, but we've reached a point where, you know, if the drums aren't loud in a pop or rock record, people think it's been mixed wrong. So yeah, I'm also interested in hearing that remix. If it's done in that sort of modern way, if it's done to sound like it was recorded as if it had been recorded, you know, now, because that would naturally bring the drums to the fore. So that could be really interesting. Yeah. But let's get on to all the joking then about Ringo, because most people have heard, and this is really what always kicks off these conversations with me at any rate, is people have heard, because it's really famous, there is a quote from John Lennon in a press conference. Somebody asks him, is Ringo the best drummer in the world? And John says, Ringo isn't even the best drummer in the Beatles. And haha, funny line. But the problem is, he never said it.
Right.
There is no source for this whatsoever. No recording, no transcript. He never said it. And a few years back, Mark Lewison, who's kind of the Beatles' semi-official biographer and has been basically writing biographies of them and researching them for, I think, literally decades, finally decided to dig into this a few years back when he was writing biographies and found out where it comes from. And it turns out, and this will mean nothing to Americans, I know, but it turns out that this is a joke made by Jasper Carrot on his comedy show in 1983. Now, for US listeners, or indeed just younger British listeners as well, Jasper Carrot is a British stand-up comedian who was very big in the 1970s and 80s and used to be very funny, and now he isn't. So it goes. But this was made in 1983.
Yeah.
After John died, and somehow it entered the public consciousness that this is a real thing that John said. And I think I know why. It's because it sounds like something John would have said. It sounds like his sense of humor.
It's clever. It's clever. It's witty and it's mean. So there you go. Yeah,
exactly. It is a genuinely funny line, but he never said it. And that line is such a source of, you know, people are just, it's like that Mark Twain joke about the coldest winter he ever spent was a summer in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Which again, he never said, but it just enters the public consciousness. And so people repeat it. And, you know, that's what always sets me off defending Ringo, because it's just not true.
You're so right. And one of the difficulties, particularly with the Beatles in popular culture, is that they're no longer a supremely talented group that made a bunch of epic albums that will never, ever be not part of the cultural lexicon internationally. It's a story. And just like Star Wars is the story about Luke Skywalker, he's the innocent farm boy who has the power of the Force that has to be nurtured. He encounters Ben Kenobi. Ben Kenobi is the wise old mage who's kind of at the end of the career, but is going to lead him into a larger world. There's Han Solo, there's Darth Vader, there's Leia Organa. Here are the roles that they have. This is a fictional story, but we can't adjust to the idea that, Luke Skywalker, he was actually a sleeper agent all along to infiltrate this new burgeoning. Like, no, that's not how the story goes. That the story goes, he's an innocent farm boy who yearns for adventure. And so the Beatles have themselves become fictional characters of their own, where even though they're real people, even though there are lots of, they have said in their own words how things happened, and they're historians and really hardworking authors who will tell you the facts of it. To the individual mind, there is Paul McCartney was the spiritual center of the group, who was the hardworking person who saw what the Beatles could be. And even though he was paired with John Lennon, who could be moody and mean and did lots of drugs, but they elevated each other. And then George Harrison grew up a lot. And then there was Ringo, the clown prince of the group. And other people will tell the story, well, John Lennon is the spiritual center of that group, the artist, the person who wanted social change and thought that music could change the world. And of course, he was saddled with Paul McCartney, who was the commercial guy who really wanted to be what he became in the 70s, which is the 70s pop star. And then there was George Harrison, the youngster who grew up in the world. And then there was the clown prince, Ringo Starr, who kept things light in the studio. And it's really hard for people to challenge what the characters in this fictional story are.
Right. None of those versions ever contain Ringo as the main character.
Exactly. They will never say that here were four supremely talented musicians that got together when they were essentially kids and therefore were able to drive themselves both as individuals and as a group into one of the tightest and most important musical groups ever. Each one of them was just as important as the other. Each one was probably just as glad to break up the group in 1970 as any of the others were. There were no bad people. There were no good people. There were just a bunch of albums we're all really, really lucky to have.
Yeah. Although it is true to say that Ringo, I mean, let's state an absolute fact. Ringo is one of the most influential drummers in history. Simply, absolutely, again, by virtue of being the first, you know, one of the first guys to do this stuff in one of the first groups to do what the Beatles did and to be as hugely popular as they were. You can't be that popular without being influential. So he was enormously influential.
I'm not wise enough about the history of music. It's really hard to imagine a day when you did not know the name of the drummer of the band. So that just goes to show how influential. I guess that's the only thing you need to know how influential someone was. When you're surprised that, oh, you mean that it wasn't this, it was different after this person came along. It wasn't just the same as everybody. Oh, I did not know that.
Right. Well, it's like, and we've talked about this on other shows. You know, science fiction movies pre and post Blade Runner, and indeed pre and post Star Wars as well. You know, there's like
dirty spaceships. You never saw a dirty spaceship in your life.
Exactly. If you didn't witness that transition, it's really hard to understand that, you know, that was the transition and that before then things weren't like that. But what I was going to say was that he did, in fairness, one of the things that he contributed to the world of music, apart from obviously, you know, his skill and legacy and everything, was this reputation for the drummer being the comedian in the group. Because I don't think I've known, you know, I've been in bands, not anymore, but when I was younger, you know, I've known musicians and drummers and what have you. I don't think most people who take up the drums do so because they're naturally clowns or comedians. I think there is a certain amount of expectation because for 50 years, drummers have been the wacky one in the group. They have been the comedian. They have been the one that everybody else gets along with, you know, that sort of keeps the group together when the mercurial genius lead singer and guitarist are having another argument. Do you know what I mean? These are massive stereotypes, and the Beatles kind of helped start a lot of those stereotypes, including those about drummers.
Yeah, I mean, they sit in the back. They're exerting so much that they... I'm amazed when I see a drummer that actually sings during a song, during the physical activity they're doing, and they do have to be, they're literally in the back.
Yeah. I mean, there have been many avant-garde bands over the years, but there aren't many that actually put the drummer at the front. You know,
we haven't talked about Keith Moon.
Even Genesis, you know, Phil Collins was the lead singer, but even his drum kit was at the back when he played it, you know, during the instrumental passages. And by the way, Phil Collins is a great defender of Ringo. And I mean, you can like Phil Collins or not. You can like his music or not. You can like Genesis or not. But I don't think anybody would ever deny that he is one of the greatest rock drummers of modern times, and he is 100% a Ringo advocate. I have read many a comment from him trying to dispel this notion that Ringo is not a good drummer, saying like, are you insane? Go and listen to what he plays. It's really complicated stuff that people even now would have trouble playing, and he makes it sound so natural.
Yeah, absolutely. I can only speak as a fan, not as an expert in music. So
believe me, I'm no expert. I'm just an avid listener.
but you look on YouTube and you see professional drummers just talking about Ringo Starr, especially even in like conferences in which here is some superstar session drummer that you never heard of, but then you see their credits. Oh, they have played on every single thing that's been important for the past 10 or 15 years.
Right. The guy who played on all of Michael Jackson's albums or something that you've never heard of.
Right. And you hear this, there's a specific one. I'll see if I can find it so you can put it in the show notes. But you hear that someone is trying in the audience is trying to be clever or trying to be ingratiating and says that he said something. I think he asked a question about like, bad drumming, and I mean, other than Ringo Starr, of course, ha 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 ha. And this drummer was very, very patient, and you could tell he has this sensei sort of attitude, which is I can just tee off on this guy, or I can make this into a teachable moment. So he just simply quietly talks about how it's about the music. It's not about you. It's not about what your career. It's about the music. And he has the iPad plugged into his console, so he starts playing Beatles music and trying to get you to listen to it. And then he has his own drum kit, and so he plays whatever song it was, but he plays it the way that that Ringo played it, which is beautiful. And they say, now here is the way that someone who wants to prove they're a good drummer would play this. And it's like, hey, they don't make it bad. And it just seems so, it just, the love and the respect that you see amongst professional musicians, it really is something to see, because it's rare that you see some, by the time someone becomes in there, gets in deep into their 70s, there's not a whole lot left to prove. There's not a whole lot left to argue that. And a lot of your favorite performers, a lot of your favorite writers, a lot of your favorite actors might have shown where the limits of their skills and talents and interests are, meaning that this director's first two movies were brilliant and their next two were kind of okay, but then they started making the same movie over and over and over again. They were very, very happy to make a movie that they and their fans would love doing, as opposed to doing something they have never, ever done before. And when you get to, you're deep in your 70s and still people who came not just a generation, but two generations after you are still in awe, having had that entire perspective of your entire catalog of music and also the music that came before it and the music that came after it. And it still stands up and you still have that respect from the position behind the drum kit, not someone in the audience making snarky comments. That really makes you want to listen to that music all over again with a brand new attitude and a brand new respect.
Absolutely. I think part of that comes from, as we said right at the start, the fact that he got better. Like, you know, he was already good. This is, again, an important thing to note for people, is that Ringo was a really in-demand drummer. Like, at the time he joined the Beatles, he was not just some guy they plucked off the street. He was already in two very successful groups who were billed above the Beatles in Hamburg. One of them was, anyway. You know, he was already a successful, in-demand, popular and recognized, you know, good drummer. And then, as we said earlier, and then he got better. He got even better and his sound evolved. And just like the rest of them, he developed new techniques and skills and literally invented, you know, passages and new ways of playing the drums. So I think that's where a lot of the, you know, the professional admiration comes from. But another element that I found, well, actually, when I was looking into that thing about the fake John Lennon quote, the same guy, Mark Lewisohn, also apparently analyzed all the Beatles recording sessions. And he found that there were, and I'm quoting here, quote, there were fewer than a dozen occasions in the Beatles' 8-year recording career where session breakdowns were caused by Ringo making a mistake. Less than a dozen over how many albums? Over 8 years? That's incredible.
Yeah. It's, I think one of the reasons why we keep talking about the Beatles is because there are lots, there's always more to understand about them. And one of the later pieces of Beatles wisdom is that when you read these books, is that each one of them seem to appreciate that even if I don't think of myself as a Beatle, hypothetically, I'm going to get to record my song, a song that I wrote with one of the greatest bass players in the industry, with one of the greatest lead guitarists in the industry, with one of the greatest drummers in the industry. My game has to be totally on point. Because Ringo is not going to just give me a basic drum track, a basic fill. I would not, as a point of pride, I can't have it said that my lame song and my lame performance was saved by the invention of the drummer or the invention of the bass player, or the invention of the lead guitarist. Each one of these people were able to catapult themselves into an entirely new orbit by virtue of the fact that they were recording with three of the most talented musicians you could possibly get in the 1960s.
Absolutely. And I'm in agreement with you. I don't think there's any question that Ringo belongs as part of that, you know, that four, no matter which one you're talking about. As you say, there are three other great musicians and Ringo is absolutely in with the rest of them.
Yeah. Each one of them, it's funny that I'm sure that there are a lot of people that have created what could be considered to be the Beatles albums through the 70s and early 80s with all the music where Ringo came in on drums, or Paul is doing an album and Ringo and George are playing on a couple tracks, or John is recording something and they brought Ringo in. Ringo seems the one who comes in on all these other albums. But you got to think that these people wouldn't be having Ringo come in to play with them. It's not just PR. Oh my God, there's a brand new track and featuring half of the Beatles in this one. It's like, no, they happen to have the personal phone number of one of the greatest drummers ever.
Yes.
So why not call them? Why not during lunch say, hey, Ringo, how much would you ask for about 2 hours of studio time a week from Thursday?
Right. When they could get literally at that point, people like McCartney and Lennon could literally get any drummer in the world in that studio. And yes, they choose to call in Ringo.
And so someone they could boss around very easily, which they could not do with Ringo. Said, nope, I want Ringo to come in and bring his Ringo-ness to this track or to the section of the album.
Yeah, well, Play It Like Ringo is a genuine sort of, you know, phrase that people use with session musicians. Not even just session musicians, but it's a sort of studio shorthand, Play It Like Ringo. And, you know, I don't think anybody really knows exactly what it means, but it's, you know, just means kind of just give it a bit more life, you know? This is something said to drummers, obviously, not to guitarists.
Right. Emotional connection. That's the thing that you can never put your finger on. Again, any piece of art, any piece of creativity, you will, if there's something that really speaks to you, it really is not the technical aspects of it. It is the emotional connection that the creator created through their expression.
Absolutely. All right. Let's bring it to a close there then. I think we've made our case. So Andy, thank you very much for coming on back on the show. It's great to have you on again. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say about popular beat combo drummers?
the price of that information is spelling my last name correctly. my blog is at anatko.com. That's IHN as in Nancy, AT as in Tom, KO. You can also see me on Instagram and on Twitter, the same handles. And the stuff I write about technology for pay is at the Chicago Sun-Times. You can see them at suntimes.com.
You're going to be starting a music column there anytime soon?
I'm hoping so, because I could use some free CDs.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my other work, including comics, books, music, and more, at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find more information about all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up, and just check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. And finally, the show notes for this episode are at UMP.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Did you want to talk at all about, you know, like Thomas the Tank Engine or anything?
I don't know much about Thomas the Tank Engine.
You don't have children, do you? So yeah, you wouldn't have watched it with kids.
I was pleased. I guess that's one of the great things about there are a lot of reasons why we love Ringo. One of them is that, of course, if he's offered to play Mr. Conductor, he's totally down with that. If you say I want to cast you in a comedy about cavemen, he's totally up for that. And he's not, and just, he doesn't take himself seriously enough to say, but how would that cast my previous serious work in a different light?
Yeah. Well, and this is the thing, like Ringo, like all of the Beatles, none of them, I mean, I say none, obviously we only have two of them left now, but you know, none of them post Beatles needed money. None of them, I don't think, ever needed to work again. You know, drug issues aside, I really think they all had more than enough money to last them a lifetime. So, you know, they were all in the very fortunate position of literally being able to do whatever they wanted to do. And yeah, and what does Ringo do? He says, well, he does like pretty much anything that anybody asks him to do. He's clearly not doing this, not doing TV shows and narrating Thomas the Tank Engine and what have you. And yeah, playing Mr. Controller on the American version for money, because he doesn't need the money. Mm. He's doing them because he wants to.
Yep. Also,
he's having fun.
Met his wife on the set of Caveman. So there you go.
Was that where he met Barbara Bach?
Barbara Bach. Yeah. He co-starred with her on, maybe for all I know, they met before that, but that's, I always assume that hanging out on a set in a woman with a fur loincloth while you yourself are wearing like Barney Rubble getup. It's like, there's a lot to fall in love with in that scenario. That's a meet cute.
Lots to unpack in that scenario. Oh, man. Contributing towards, over here anyway, towards the sort of the Ringo being a bad drummer mythology, there was also, and I confess when I was a kid, I laughed at this. There was a comedy double act of here, Mel Smith and Griffith Jones, who did a series called Alas, Smith and Jones, comedy sketch show. And one of them, one of the sketches that I have never forgotten in my life was a parody of a documentary about Abbey Road Recording Studios, you know, with them playing the parts of George Martin and Brian Epstein and people like that. And one of the, it's a very, very short segment. And this is years ago. I doubt it's even on YouTube because we're talking literally about the same time, like 83, 84. And I remember, I think it was Griffith Jones playing George Martin, says, somebody says something like, so how did you get the unique Beatles sound? And he says, well, let me give you an example. This is what a cymbal sounds like. And he plays a tape recorder and he goes, ksh. And this is what a cymbal sounds like backwards. And he plays the tape recorder and he goes, ksh. And this is what a cymbal sounds like when Ringo plays it. And he goes, dunk. Again, funny joke, not accurate, but you know, funny joke. But again, that's, it's, I think, you know, for my generation, we all watched that show. That show was watched by millions of people, and it just, all these things, Red Dwarf famously had a couple of Ringo jokes in it during its run. All these things just self-perpetuate.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were mentioning Phil Collins, that now every, Phil, I don't know why Phil Collins is just the generic punchline to a lot of jokes. When I can understand, I think he himself said, well, I understand how people can are sick and tired of how overplayed like my hits were back in the day, but they hold up. They're good. This is good music. It's not junk. And sometimes you really do, you really have to be on guard of this, like, public, this like schoolyard behavior where for whatever reason, this one kid has been designated as the goat for the entire school year, yep, for the entire, yep, class, that there's this boy, this girl has not done anything wrong. There's not anything about their personality, but word has gone out through the telegraph that this is the person that we're going to abuse and pick on. If we're going to make a joke, it's going to be about this person. And it really is kind of a shabby way to even to treat adults, even adults who are multi-gazillionaires like Phil Collins and Ringo Starr and can get anything they want simply by nodding in the direction of the thing that they want.
I think with Phil Collins, part of it, and it's much worse over here than in America. I think part of it is that over here, kind of paradoxically, really, we have a very puritanical music press and our music fandom in general. It's getting less so, thank goodness, as time goes on. But certainly in the 80s and 90s, our music press and music fandom in general in Britain was very puritanical, very against the idea of selling out, and, you know, against sort of naked commercialism and all that sort of thing. And I really think that's a lot of the problem that we as a, you know, as a collective, not me personally, but we as a collective people had with Phil Collins and sort of, and Genesis as well to an extent, but certainly Phil Collins, partly because he was unashamed about how successful he was. You know, he was not embarrassed by the fact that he was enormously successful and very, very wealthy. And because he did, I mean, his first album is, you know, a like incredible emotional sort of, you know, vulnerable, nakedly emotional kind of work of art. And then, you know, as time went on, in came the horn section and, you know, he started making these very blatantly commercial records. They are, as you say, they are still good records. If you just take them by themselves, they are good, solid records with good songs, but because so many of them were so blatantly commercial, yeah, I really think that kind of rubbed our, as I say, quite puritanical music press the wrong way. And so it develops again into this thing of, let's pick on somebody, let's find somebody, yeah, to run down.
It's the other difficulty is being unable to separate, I didn't like this one album or I didn't like this one movie, from this person's entire legacy. And this,
yes,
it practically got me upset, all the ways that George Lucas has been run down. That, so it was, and kind of like the thing where it's the fun punchline of the joke is to make fun of George Lucas, but it seems like every hack comedian, including some pretty good ones, or making jokes about how George Lucas raped my childhood and that's because he made the prequels and they're horrible. And I was like, first of all, be really careful about how you use the word rape, number one. Number two, so you're saying, so let's review. THX-1138, American Graffiti, Star Wars first three movies, Indiana Jones of the first, at least the first couple movies, none of them matter now, because he made two, maybe three movies that you really didn't like. And for that reason, he's going to be the laughingstock for the rest of his life in your eye. You're kind of a total ingrate, and with a total lack of perspective. That I'm not saying that I liked I liked the prequels either. I didn't care much for Radioland Murders as a movie either. But that doesn't. It's like I'm able to say that he will have made seven movies that are brilliant, that define everything I love about the movies. That apart from their quality as movies. Define some of my happiest moments as a child that in many ways influenced how I think of the world and how big my imagination is. But he made two or three movies that you didn't like. So he raped your childhood and he's a horrible person. And every time we mention him, we have to talk about Jar Jar Binks. Like, no, we don't. We really don't.
It's like, bringing it back to music. That's I was an absolutely enormous REM fan when I was younger, and that kind of like their later albums for me did very little for me. From sort of about early 90s onwards, I lost interest. They weren't making music that appealed to me anymore. But yeah, it's not as if I now can't bear, and I literally didn't even buy a lot of their later albums. It's not as if I suddenly now can't bear to go back and listen to their 1980s output. I still regularly do and love it. It's great stuff. It's not, just because somebody may evolve into an artist that you don't like doesn't suddenly wipe all their previous work off the face of the earth and shouldn't change your opinion of it, I don't think, but clearly some people do.
You're really I'm sorry. Maybe you want to edit.
That's all right.
Getting a little bit too excited. The terms of service that you click through when you agree to watch my movies specifically said that I'm not going to promise you that I will not occasionally make a stupid movie for money, because I like money and the things that we can do with it. Even if you just wanted to spend it on, I'm going to buy the entire production run of the latest McLaren supercar and just crash them into each other via remote control. He's free to do that as well.
Marcus Brigstocke, a British comedian, was on Richard Herring's podcast, the Leicester Square Theatre podcast, or Rehearlistoper, as it's snappily named. And they were talking about, what's the guy who directed Love Actually? And Richard Curtis, that's it. Yeah. And again, a bit like Ringo, Richard Curtis gets a bad rap. People are, or more like Phil Collins maybe, people say about how all he makes now are these terrible, sappy rom-coms, blah, blah, blah. And all of that aside, Brigstocke was like, that may all be true. However, what you don't know about Richard Curtis is that every 2 years, he literally spends 6 months working for the Comic Relief charity, which is the comedians' family relief charity that was started in the wake of Live Aid and stuff. We have Red Nose Day over here every couple of years to celebrate it and do a big fundraiser and what have you. And Richard Curtis is one of the founders of Comic Relief and is still not just like on the board, but still an active participant. And he's like, he literally spends 6 months every 2 years working on Comet Relief out in Africa, raising money, overseeing projects, putting his life into this thing, and making movies like Love Actually is what helps him be able to do that. So, Richard Curtis is better than you. Shut up.
Yeah. The only thing that I would say in closing is that he's the one person that when he shows up on TV or in print flashing a peace sign, that I don't think that that's silly. I think that's wonderful. I think that's cheery. And I hope he continues to do so for as many decades as Ringo wants to remain on this planet.
Hello.
Hey there. Do you want video?
No. That sounded
that was a very fast no. But I totally understand it. If not for the fact that I was out to breakfast with friends, so I'm showered, I'm shaved, I'm dressed, I would have not even asked.
That came out way worse than I intended it to.